It's a bold new coalition aimed to helping some of the most vulnerable young people here on the First Coast. Good Monday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. You can tune into the audio feed of this program right now on our Facebook page, too. Just ahead, we'll tell you about a new program to help homeless LGBTQ youth right here on the First Coast. 549-2937 to join us. Then later, a peek inside the issues of the new spring issue of Flamingo Magazine. Getting ready for this weekend's Gate River Run, the 40th annual, plus Cole Pepper and all your weekend news and notes from the world of sports. All of that ahead. But first this hour, it's an ambitious goal to end youth homelessness on the First Coast by the year 2020. In Jacksonville, 60% of homeless young people identify as LGBTQ. That's higher than the national average, which is already a shocking 40%. To address that, a new coalition has formed, working together to start a new system of care for our most vulnerable young people here on the First Coast. LGBTQ kids experiencing homelessness now have a place to go and more help that they need for some critically needed services. Here with more, we welcome Cindy Watson, Executive Director of Jasmine. Good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Don Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness, Inc. here on the First Coast.
Good morning.
And Kim Sertivan, she's President and CEO of this area's Youth Crisis Center.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the fact that 60% of the homeless kids in our area identify as LGBTQ, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender? Often they're kicked out of their homes due to their orientation. Give us a call as we talk about this new coalition, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. You can email the show, tweet the show, or weigh in on Facebook. Cindy Watson, let's begin with you. You're the executive director of Jasmine, and you've been working with this population of kids for years. What's new and what's changed in terms of helping this group of young people?
Well, Melissa, youth homelessness is not new. And LGBT youth homelessness is not new. We've known for over two decades young people who were homeless, who are kicked out or on their own. But what is exciting and new today is this collaboration that we are engaging with the Changing Homelessness Coalition and Youth Crisis Center to really create a structure to support in a new way finding emergency and permanent housing for these young people.
Don Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness. Of course, your goal is to house homeless people all through this area, and you've made so much progress on that. But in particular now, you're partnering up with these other agencies to address a really specific population. Tell us about it.
Yes. So when we say youth and youth homelessness, we're talking about kids, young people, 18 to 24. This is a particularly concerning time. If we are able to quickly rehouse them or prevent them from ever becoming homeless, we prevent them from being the next wave of what we determine as or call chronically homeless. So these are more long-term homeless people on the streets. Young people are very resilient if given the right supports and connections. They are able to bounce back and they will never be back in our system.
We want your calls about this at 549-2937. Kim Sertivan, how is Youth Crisis Center helping with this new partnership?
Well, Youth Crisis Center currently has space to be able to house young folks that are coming in that are on the streets and in an emergent and crisis situation. So, you know, we've had this empty space now for going on 3 years. And after a conversation with Cindy and Dawn about what to do with this empty space, it became apparent that there was an unmet need for the LGBT primary population. So for our space, it would be to have them come in and get immediate attention, food, shelter, immediate services so that they could find themselves to become stable and then make a better decision on what permanency looks like for them.
Let's talk about the reasons why this population ends up homeless. Cindy.
Well, first of all, there's still many families that don't understand or really just are not prepared to support a young adult who is LGBT.
They don't accept their orientation.
They don't accept that they're gay or lesbian, and particularly they don't accept the transgender or the gender nonconforming identity that's emerging with a young adult. And
tell me a little bit more about that, because so often we get calls about transgender issues and gender nonconforming. That whole aspect, that whole T in the acronym LGBT, mm-hmm. is so poorly understood by so many of us. Talk a little bit more about that group of kids and some of the issues that they're dealing with and what they're going through and why families have such a hard time, often parents have such a hard time accepting these kids.
Well, you know, adolescence is a time of determining one's identity. That's the major developmental task of a teenager and an adolescent. And so for a lot of young people, figuring out who am I is a big part of that. For transgender young people, by the time they're adolescent, they've already had a strong sense that that their gender and their body aren't aligned. And so they're in a process of not just figuring that out, but trying to live that out. Mm-hmm. It's a new idea for a lot of people in older generations like mine. And so it's an idea that, you know, sometimes parents just don't understand what's happening or they don't like it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of parents think, well, this kid is 18. They need to be on their own. Get out. And so that can be what happens. And I know that many, many 18-year-olds are not ready to be fully supportive. They're not ready to be completely independent. They still need a good bit of adult support to make it in their lives. But without that, they end up bouncing from couch to couch. They end up sleeping in cars. They end up sleeping on the street. And that's really where Jasmine has played an important role, because we have a youth center that's a very robust youth center that's very welcoming to all young people. And so when these kids come to our doors, we say, we'll accept you for who you are. We'll support you, we'll wrap our arms around you, and we'll help you get connected. And so our role, particularly with these homeless youth, is to be the front door, is to be the open door that welcomes young people in. And with this partnership, we really see that as we welcome them in, we can also help connect them to very real housing resources mm-hmm. that we don't sustain on our campus, but that our partners at YCC and throughout the coalition do have.
And if you're just tuning in, ending youth homelessness on the First Coast by 2020, that's the goal of Jasmine Youth Crisis Center and Changing Homelessness, Inc. They're all here in studio. Most of those homeless kids in our area identify as gay or lesbian or transgender. What do you think about that? What are your questions for this group? 549-2937. Don Gilman, who heads up Changing Homelessness, Inc., the resources are there, and I know it's your goal to get to zero homelessness here on the First Coast,
yes.
to house the homeless, as many as possible.
Correct. So as Cindy was saying, when we say housing, we mean permanent housing. That means that the young person would have a legal right to stay where they are. With younger people, a lot of times that is a family reconnection, either with their direct biological family or another trusted adult, maybe a more distant relative, but someone in the area. Some young people are ready to be more self-sustaining than others. Those we would try to connect more into apartments and jobs and education out in the wider community. They'll be able to sustain themselves with enough income and those kinds of supports.
And then, Kim, at Youth Crisis Center, once they're housed, there are referrals to help with life skills, maybe mental health services. There's a whole range of needs here, right?
Correct. Yes. We would go ahead and begin an assessment to determine where are they with their life skills training. You know, many of these young folks lack the basic life skills, period. And so this would be able to have them immediately meet with someone where they are on the spectrum relative to life skills training. Mental health is such a core element that these young folks have lacked in their history, that they've just continued to survive but never have had anything dealt with. So the mental health counseling is a core element of this whole solution of trying to end homelessness. Mm-hmm. So all of this could be either provided on our campus through YCC, or if there's a specialized entity that we need to refer out to, is to have that collaboration to make that immediate referral.
And the statistic that you put out to the media when you announced this partnership, really caught our eye. Nationally, Cindy Watson of Jasmine, 40% of homeless youth are in this LGBT group. In Jacksonville, it's 60%, much higher than the national average. Why is that?
Well, Jacksonville may be a little behind in some of its sense of acceptance for the LGBT community. I do think we're catching up. But we still see large numbers of LGBT youth who are homeless.
And can you tell, without naming names, can you tell us some stories of what these kids are telling you when they come to you and they have no housing?
I mean, I've talked with kids who whose parent discovered that they were gay or who began to understand they were trans and said, here's a bag, pack this, get out, don't come back. You know, that's a very traumatic experience to be rejected so abruptly and forcefully by a parent. And so the trauma that kids have experienced can go really deep. And if a kid goes out, then where do they go? And a lot of young people have no idea where to go. So they do end up sleeping on the street, sleeping in cars, or kind of crashing here or there, which makes them very, very vulnerable to other kinds of issues. They're vulnerable to violence. They sometimes have to engage in survival sex just to have a place to sleep or food to eat. You know, they're exposed to substances and all kinds of other, you know, health issues. And so those kinds of things, we want to mitigate that. We want to, you know, catch them on the front end. One of the things that we are doing as a part of this partnership, Melissa, is we are developing at Jasmine a family support and acceptance project so that we can work with some of those families who want to really figure out how to understand and don't want their kid to end up on the street but are still struggling with acceptance.
Acceptance. And what type of journey do you see some of these families go through?
Well, I believe that most parents want the best for their children. And they don't want to see their kids end up on the street, but they really have no idea what else to do or how else to respond. And so providing resources, providing workshops, an opportunity to talk with other parents who've been there, those are the kinds of things I think we can support. I know Youth Crisis Center has a long history of family therapy and family reunification, so this partnership really enhances that for those families that need more intensive kinds mm-hmm. of support. So we're really excited about helping some of these kids, maybe a lot of these kids, end up back at home or in family resources. And then those who aren't ready for that or for whom that's just not an option, finding the resources for stable housing. At YCC has Touchstone Village, which is a great opportunity for young adults, or in other places within the coalition.
If you're just tuning in, Jacksonville is a city that passed an updated human rights ordinance to cover LGBT adults, protection from discrimination in the areas of jobs, housing, and public accommodations. We get lots of calls about that. But we need your calls right now as we talk about this new three-agency effort to protect homeless kids who identify as LGBT. We want your calls at 549-2937. You know, often you hear about different agencies and nonprofits working in silos in this community, but here is a really good example of all of you joining forces, putting all of your strengths together to try to help people that need it the most.
Yes, and while the three of us are kind of the initial face on this, there's another dozen to two dozen agencies within the community that we are all connected to and have really valuable resources and are true partners in working through this effort. In Jacksonville, we have not had a focus on youth homelessness, which means we don't have any really specific dedicated resources to those 18 to 24-year-olds. Some cities are ahead of us. There's a lot of cities in Florida that are about the same place as we are. We're trying to figure out how do we, as partners, either realign resources or find other ways to make these needed resources available to young people. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, we've had some great success on getting down really close to zero on veteran homelessness. Mm-hmm. A lot of that came with a really big infusion from the VA, supporting us as a community with multiple agencies to go out, find who was at risk or actually homeless, and then rapidly rehouse them. We don't have that kind of federal support for youth, but we're figuring out how do we as a community create that and support these young people so they go on and are really productive contributing members to Jacksonville and our community.
And we have a great philanthropical community here in Jacksonville that I've talked with many people who are very concerned about youth homelessness. And so we really see this as an opportunity to build up those resources locally. For example, Jasmine was just given a building on our campus, a third building on our campus in Riverside. And we're going to use that as sort of the front door for this project to welcome young people in, to provide some of those immediate kinds of needs like food and storage and mailboxes and showers and laundry and those kinds of things as we help them connect to the system. We want to find the resources to build out this great space at YCC and then to be able to continue to build these options in Jacksonville.
And YCC has been around since 1974, so serving young folks in our community who have been homeless and runaways, we've done it for quite a while, and we've had some really great successes, and 94% of our kids go back home, and they're staying out of any kind of system, dependency or delinquency, and so this would replicate that system. It's just serving an 18 to 24-year-old, which oftentimes developmentally, they're still in adolescence, and so it's taking what we have done so well and forming a great partnership to serve an unmet need.
All right. Lots of calls for the heads of Jasmine, Changing Homelessness, Inc., and the Youth Crisis Center as they work to try to put their forces together and help the most vulnerable young homeless people here on the First Coast, LGBTQ kids, 549-2937. Cass is along I-95 this morning. Hey, Cass, good morning.
Good morning. I have, along with many people, really enjoyed watching that mini-series last week on ABC, When We Rise. And while I was watching, I was thinking how terrific it would be for the young people in Jasmine to see this and to see how much of the movement was led by very young people who had been rejected or had to leave their communities and start over. And I was wondering if there was any chance Jasmine would be able to set that up at some time as a program for your youth.
That's a great suggestion. It's already occurred to most of us on staff, and we do have the resources to do that. And it is notable that homeless LGBT people is not a new thing. For many generations, there were no resources or very few resources, and kids had to really just find their way. And so it is a new era. We're in a new time where we have actual community resources available.
549-2937. Thomas on the South Side. Hey, Thomas, how are you?
Hi, how's it going? Hey, during my annual end-of-year giving, in addition to WJCT, I learned about the Trevor Project this year from John Oliver and made that part of my sort of annual donations that I do towards the end of the year. Is there any ways you'd recommend to help the Jasmine Project or similar organizations? I guess I've heard about the Jasmine Project on this program a couple of times. It seems like a good organization to support, but just ways the community can get involved or help out these organizations.
Sure. Thanks for that. Thanks for supporting WJCT as well. How can people help?
Well, you're welcome to visit our website, www.jasmyn.org. And you can find out lots of information about the things we're doing, and there's a donate button there. And we give campus tours, and we're really interested in engaging people as volunteers and as partners. I'm sure ycc.org is another place that you can contribute.
ycc.org, right? For Youth Crisis Center.
Right.
Been around since the 70s.
1974.
That's right. They can use your donations, too. And Changing Homelessness, Inc.,
yeah, and it's changinghomelessness.org. So that's another website. What we do is more of a community-wide, think of us as the backbone. If you're really interested in working directly with the youth, either YCC through their program building out that emergency shelter for young people, or for Jasmine, who works also every day with young people in need.
All right. And here are a couple of tweets. Dennis tweets the show, "I pray for more churches to get involved in dealing with homelessness in an effective, organized way." Here's a tweet from Joseph.
What is the standard medical view on transgender people? Is it blanket acceptance, or is it still seen as something requiring a form of treatment? Let's get into a clinical discussion, a medical explanation for listeners who really still, I think, there's still a lot of confusion and lack of understanding about what's going on in terms of a transgender person. And as you're talking about, Cindy Watson, a young person who is coming to terms with the fact that they are transgender. What does the medical community say about this population?
Well, there's a growing consensus, and has been for quite a few years, that gender fluidity or transgender experience is one of the many ways that human behavior exists, and so it's not pathologized. It's not considered a pathology. There are standards of care that the local medical community are reviewing now, pediatricians, and there are some doctors locally, but in other communities as well, that look at how to respond to transgender young people with hormone therapy, with mental health therapy, and with surgical intervention when that's necessary or appropriate or required or requested.
Mm-hmm. And all of these approaches in terms of providing support for transgender kids, putting the three of you together, I'm sure pulling these resources is going to make quite a bit of difference.
It will, and it already has. You know, I posed this question some years back in our current residential program that we have, is that we did have a trans person come through. And this was something very new to us on what do we do? Where do we place this child? Is it on the female or the male side? And so I reached out to Cindy to find out about this because we had not experienced someone that was out and letting us know about this. And so through that, it opened up dialogue statewide through one of our largest funding sources, which is the Florida Network of Youth and Family Services. And so we become quite familiar with this population and really just understanding more about this person and what they're going through from the parental side, from the child's side. And so you really need to make sure that they're comfortable. Youth Crisis Center is dedicated to ensure safety and that we have a safe space for the individuals to come through. And so it is becoming one that we're continuing to monitor and to ensure that we're providing everything that we can to ensure that they're moving through their childhood and their adulthood.
Well, we thank you all for being here and sharing this with us. Keep us posted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cindy Watson of Jasmine, Don Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness, and Kim Sertivan, who runs Youth Crisis Center, all with us this morning. Much more still ahead. Later, Cole Pepper and the latest sports news, including the end of the season for UNF men's basketball. Also, a look ahead to the 40th annual Gate River Run. Are you going to try to tame the green monster? But up next, a look inside the spring edition of Flamingo magazine. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Attorney Tad Delagall, Jacksonville. Professional licensure defense, non-compete agreements, severance agreements, and public and private employment litigation. Information at protectingcareers.com or 633-5000. Delagall Law Offices, PA.
The Battle of Olustee was the largest conflict of the American Civil War fought on Florida soil, with nearly 3,000 soldiers killed in 3 hours. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will go to the annual Battle of Olustee reenactment. We'll discuss World War II soldiers at Camp Gordon Johnston and look at the religion of Santeria. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman. what to do.
Welcome back. Well, the statewide magazine Flamingo is celebrating 1 year this spring. They launched a year ago in Ponte Vedra Beach with the goal of covering all of Florida. And the spring issue hits newsstands this week with an iconic Florida theme. We've got a look inside as we welcome publisher Jamie Rich to the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
I can't believe it's been a year since you launched this. Time flies.
I can't believe it either. It's been really exciting.
And you had the vision. You saw an opportunity to create a magazine that would cover all of Florida, all the different cities around Florida, all the different cultures, food, dining, places to go, things to do. There's so much variety around the state. It's a big job to cover the whole state, but you're doing it.
Exactly. Well, our goal is to create the destination for Floridians for intelligent content, that Florida magazine, if you will, from Pensacola to Key West.
Mm-hmm. And so now you're out with the spring issue, which is your year celebration, 1 year of publishing. What's inside the spring issue?
Well, this is our iconic Florida issue. We launched last spring with an iconic Florida issue, but we feel like there are so many things that are emblematic of the state, places, people, experiences, that we needed more than one issue to celebrate them. So it's those things that when you think of Florida, they pop to mind. For instance, one of the things is the Sebring and Daytona races, endurance races. That's coming up. Spring break is coming up. So if you want to take a trip down to Sebring, see some iconic sports car racing, our own Hurley Haywood, who lives in the area, is the grandmaster of the Sebring race, the 12 hours at Sebring. So That's one of our big feature stories. We also have some iconic architecture stories in there. If you are out traveling around the state this spring break and you want to head down to Sarasota, we have a really fascinating feature story on Cadizan, which many people may not know what Cadizan is, but it is an architectural monument built by the Ringlings. It's a palace by the sea, and it's got a great history, 100 years old. Some people may recognize it from the movie Great Expectations, and it was dilapidated building back then, and now it's been restored to its
very nice
grandeur.
And you also have a profile in this issue of FSU's Bobby Bowden. Tell me about that.
That's correct. Well, there aren't many iconic coaches in the U.S. That are more legendary than Bobby Bowden. So we felt like with our Icons issue, what a better place to delve into his story. Recently, he also had a documentary out that was kind of looking at his career. So it was perfect timing for us to look at the life of Bobby Bowden. And I think Gators and Seminoles alike, and anyone, just football fans in general, are going to enjoy this piece.
And so when you talk about Florida icons, you've picked some other interesting icons. There's a piece on sea turtles. That's certainly a Florida image that comes to mind. You've also profiled Lilly Pulitzer designs, which are becoming pretty ubiquitous this time of year.
Exactly.
Tell us about Lilly Pulitzer and her history in Florida.
Well, many people may know current modern-day Lilly and the prints and dresses and really a full line of home designs that are now recognizable with her fun prints. But really, we focused on the vintage Lilly and the story behind those original designs and dresses and where those prints came from. And
the kind Jackie Kennedy might have worn, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And those prints actually came out of Key West, out of an artist colony in Key West. And a lot of people don't realize that part of the story, where many people have read about Lilly and her juice stand and how she sort of, the dress line evolved out of her business of creating fresh juices in Palm Beach, but those fun, iconic patterns actually were the result of her relationship with an artist colony in Key West, which is still, the building is still there today, and some of those artists and their families are still around today. It's a really fascinating read.
Going through this magazine is incredible because it's a huge state with a completely different feel depending on where you go. Northeast Florida is different from the Panhandle. Central Florida is specific. And then South Florida and Key West and Southwest Florida have their own cultures and traditions. It's incredible how much you pack into this issue every time because it's not a homogeneous kind of state. There, it's like six different states in one.
Exactly. Well, that's what makes Florida so great. So we really try to tie all those regions together, celebrate our diversities, and give Floridians that place to go to learn about each other, to learn about the different areas, to learn about the different cultures, to be inspired to go out of your own zone, out of your own bubble. I think a lot of people can sort of, mm-hmm. we're all guilty of getting trapped in our own sort of weekend trips or what we think of. If I'm going to go on a holiday in Florida, this is what I'm going to do. So we really try to inspire people to think outside of the box. And it's not just a travel magazine. There's plenty of stories just about people and experiences and restaurants and cultures. But hopefully when they pick it up and read it, they're inspired to get out and do something different, look at Florida through a new lens.
And people still want to pick up a paper magazine. And you can read them digitally and everything.
Absolutely.
But there's still something about picking up a tangible print product in your hand and reading it. You were able to get distribution through Publix stores, which is a huge deal in Florida.
That's right. We're available on newsstands throughout Publix, Winn-Dixie, Target. Now we've expanded that distribution. We're in Barnes & Noble. We've added Fresh Market, Whole Foods.
Oh, you're everywhere now.
The airport will now be at Jacksonville Airport. The latest issue will be debuting there this spring. So when you're traveling for spring break, if you're not taking a road trip and you're flying out of Jacksonville, look for it at Hudson News.
Wow. So much growth in 1 year. So what are your long-term goals for Flamingo Magazine?
Well, we really want Flamingo to be the destination for Floridians to turn to for inspiration, for all great stories about Florida.
You're on your way. And I'm so impressed. I can't believe it's been a year since you first started this.
And you've been part of the journey as well, Melissa.
I know. I wrote an article for One Magazine, and I need to come up with some more pitches for you.
We'd love to get you involved.
If anyone listening right now who wants to be inside the pages of Flamingo and you have a good story, email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And thanks so much, and congratulations to publisher Jamie Rich. The spring issue of Flamingo, a statewide magazine based here in our area, on newsstands right now. And good luck, and we'll see you a year from now, I guess.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day. Have a great spring break, and enjoy the spring issue of Flamingo Magazine.
In a moment, Cole with some sports news and a preview of this Saturday's 40th annual Gate River Run. That's after this.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, Washington lobbyists.
We have begun to drain the swamp of government corruption by imposing a 5-year ban on lobbying by executive branch officials.
The lobbying business is very much alive and well. Why is that? And what do lobbyists actually do? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Should schools be required to offer recess? Does Florida need new fracking regulations? These and other important questions are up for debate in this year's legislative session. WJCT and public radio stations across Florida are teaming up for coverage of hot topics expected to make news. Hear these stories during Morning Edition. Decision Florida coverage next week here on 89.9 WJCT.
Relax Radio, playing the soundtrack of your life nightly at midnight, only on 89.9 FM WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. The nation's largest 15K runs through Jacksonville this weekend. It's almost time for the 40th annual Gate River Run. Doug Tillett with JTC Running is here with a preview. Can't believe it's been 40 years for this race. Doug, good to see you. Good morning.
Hi, how are you today?
And I can't believe that this race is not only it's the largest of its kind in the country, but it's been around for 40 years. It's amazing.
I know. Yeah, this will be the 40th running, and it doesn't seem like it's slowing down any. We've got a lot of people that will be showing up, and it's a great celebration of running in the city.
Absolutely. Now, over the weekend, they had a retro river run. Was the JTC Running Club part of that? What happened with that?
I ran the retro
you
river
ran
run.
The retro river run.
It was a lot
run.
Of fun. It started from the landing and finished at the landing. And the idea was, you know, you could wear clothes like you used to wear back in 78 when the first river run was run. And we only charged $5 for the race. So that was kind of a retro aspect to it, too.
Didn't they call them streakers? Were there actual streakers?
Well, they wore clothes.
Okay, they wore something. But they were in 70s style running attire?
Some of us were, yeah.
Tell me what they had on.
Well, one thing they asked us is if you had any old River Run shirts to wear your oldest shirt. And there were a few people there that had shirts going back to the original one in 78, and then quite a few people, you know, with races since then. Some of the streakers dressed up. The shorts were really short back in those days, so I was a little too embarrassed personally.
Yeah, and like high tube socks and short little shorts.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that was sort of the look, and like a sweatband around your forehead maybe.
Yeah, that's right. We had people dressed up, and they looked good.
Now, are there people that have run the Gate River Run all 40 years in a row?
That is who the streakers
that
are.
That is who they are. Okay, so how many people are we talking about?
It's 41, I think.
Wow.
I know, that's a lot. And you think
that's
about
that's a high amount of people.
Yeah, so if somebody was 30 years old when the first river run happened, well, now they're going to be 70. And
that's impressive.
Yeah.
Because it's a tough run. And in particular, the Hart Bridge, or what people that run this race call the Green Monster.
Yes.
Has slayed many runners over the years, hasn't it?
You know, I think that just about anybody who makes it to the base of the Hart Bridge and the race is going on, they all make it over it one way or another. You know, you're going to get over the Hart Bridge, but it might make your time slower than you were going to be otherwise.
What's it like going over that? I mean, I've never run that bridge, so I've just heard tales of the horror of it all. What's it like for you as a runner? How tough is that bridge, really?
Well, it is hard because it is an uphill, and we don't have much uphill training here in Jacksonville. Although there are some people who would do downtown bridge loops over the main and back over the Acosta. The secret to running the Hart Bridge is when you start with the uphill, you lean forward, you shorten your stride, you pump your arms, and look about 12 feet ahead. And then as the time goes by, all of a sudden you find yourself at the top, and instead it's time to lengthen your stride and just careen down the bridge.
Right, and then you're home free.
Right, that's
now,
right.
Now, this is the largest 15K race in the United States, the 40th annual Gate River Run, happening Saturday, March 11th. It will once again serve as the USA 15K championship, with America's top Olympic athletes competing for $85,000 in prize money. Last year, almost 25,000 runners and walkers participated, not just in the 15K, but there are some other runs and walks taking place too, right?
Yes, there are. At the same time the 15-kilometer race starts, there's the Times Union 5K for Charity, which is run on a different course down to downtown and back, and there are several thousand runners running that. And then later on in the morning, at around 10 o'clock, I think, they have the Junior River Run, which are one-mile races, and they're by age group. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they even have a diaper dash.
Now, how many years have you done the Gate River Run?
My first one was 1983.
Oh, so you're not a streaker. You haven't been at this since the 70s.
No, I haven't.
You're a newbie.
Yeah, kind of. And I took a break for a few of them because in 1999, in February, I fell down and broke my leg.
Aww.
And so I didn't get to run the race, you know. So,
well, what advice do you have for those who might come out for the very first time?
My advice would be don't start too fast. You know, take an easy pace at the beginning and enjoy the race. You'll have plenty of other river runs in the future to set a record. And if you don't go out too fast for the very first one, well, then that gives you an even easier time setting a new record for yourself the next time that you go.
All right. It's the 40th annual Gate River Run. He's Doug Tillett of JTC Running Club. Hard to believe it's the 40th year for this, and that dozens of people have run it every single year since its inception. It's coming up this Saturday, so register now at firstplaysports.com. Doug, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for letting us on your radio program.
More sports news from Cole in just a moment.
the next Fresh Air, Samantha Bee, the host and co-creator of the TBS satirical news show Full Frontal, and Joe Miller, co-creator and head writer. The show takes a comedic feminist perspective on politics and is focused lately on the Trump administration. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
It's a new administration's first 100 days, and the news is flying fast.
Protesters arrived here.
Keystone XL pipeline.
The Affordable Care Act.
New refugee
Obamacare.
Admissions for
all things considered, will be here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every day.
It's easy to listen to WJCT, even when you're not near a radio. Just visit WJCTnews.org from your phone or tablet. On our mobile site, you're just one click away from a 24-hour live stream of our programming, and you'll also have easy access to all of the top local news stories. Listen live on WJCT's mobile website, WJCTnews.org.
Welcome back, and finally this hour from the Gate River Run to what's next on the Jaguars' off-season calendar.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
It's Monday, and that means it's time for Cole Pepper with all your sports news and notes. And hey, Cole, we just heard that I guess there are guys and women who have run this Gate River Run every year for 40 years. That's amazing.
It's so impressive. I know a few of them. And it's amazing that, just think about the things that can happen in a run. I am the world's worst runner, but I do run a bit. And
no, I think I am.
We may have to have a runoff to see who's the worst. Talking with some of the folks who have run these races for years and years and years, some of them would say, hey, I had an injury 2 weeks before and I kind of toughed it through because it matters to them to run the Gate River Run. It is one of the great community sports events in Jacksonville every year. And you start talking about things like the Players' Championship and Florida Georgia and Jaguars games. The Gate River Run is right up there. Mm-hmm. And I'll be going down to the Expo this week and checking out everything going on there. And then certainly celebrating with some friends who will finish afterwards.
Now, you did the Retro Run over the weekend. How was that?
Great. Great event. I considered wearing the tube socks.
The 70s look?
Yeah, but having run in tube socks one other time, I've realized how uncomfortable tube socks are to run in.
I know. Why did they wear those? And they're like the most unattractive things you can possibly put on your body.
Melissa, it was the 70s. There were a lot of things that nobody can explain.
It's true. Now, okay, so with entries ahead of last year's pace, 16,000 running, 6 Olympians running. Gosh darn, that's amazing. And most just doing it not to win, but, you know, just to have the fun of it.
Yeah, to have that story. And, 16 bands along the way, and there'll be people perhaps with an adult beverage or two at some roadside tables. So beware if you're looking for a water station, that it's not a fire water station.
And just $5 to enter as they celebrate the 40-year anniversary.
Yeah, that was for the Retro River
Run. It
was on Saturday.
Okay, so that's happening Saturday. Meanwhile, I know you want to share with us what's going on with the Jaguars and the NFL Combine.
Yeah, they just got back from the NFL Combine this past weekend. And one of the big storylines for the Jaguars is whether they would take their fourth pick in the draft and spend it on a running back. There are so few impact running backs in the National Football League in this day and age. However, last year, the Cowboys used a top 5 pick on Ezekiel Elliott, who became a rookie sensation as a running back. Now, they have a very good offensive line. That allowed the Jaguars to draft Jalen Ramsey, which seems like it's worked out for all parties involved. But maybe, with Tom Coughlin now calling the shots, making the running game more of a focus could potentially be there. Remember, this is the guy who drafted Fred Taylor. Mm-hmm. This is the guy who went out in his first draft, and after drafting Tony Boselli, also drafted James Stewart. So having a big, strong, fast running back is an option. And there are two guys who could potentially fit there. Leonard Fournette, who was once the number one recruit in the country and went to LSU, it has been tremendous, and Dalvin Cook from Florida State are both being considered among the guys who could be top 5 picks as running backs. I tend to think that the Jaguars under Tom Coughlin will go for big bodies because that's what Coughlin likes. But both guys, Cook and Fournette, had good, not great, workouts at the combine. I don't think they hurt their cause at all, but I don't think they helped to the point where it makes them an absolute must get.
What else are you hearing about the changes Coughlin is bringing to this franchise?
I've talked to some folks on the inside who have said that there is no doubt that his presence in the building is being felt, and
right.
that one of the big things that he's looking for is for people to really have buy-in. You know, players, staff, you name it, everybody needs to be bought into the thing. I'm not sure that that was necessarily something that was missing under Gus Bradley, but the way that you buy into Tom Coughlin is different than the way you would buy into Gus Bradley. Gus was not about was about taking the pressure off and about taking distractions and everything else away. Coughlin wants everybody to be on the edge at all times to make sure they are prepared for every eventuality at any time, and that nobody is outworked, you know, in that building. So that's something that Coughlin has, you know, always been known for, and he continues
almost like
to
an intimidating presence.
It can be,
yeah.
And I don't think it's so much about, you know, the iron fist as it is setting the expectations. And you and I have talked about this before in this segment. That was what was missing more than anything with the Jaguars. The other thing I think that Coughlin will do here is really identify, how good is this roster? Because a lot of folks have talked about how good they think the roster was, or they did under the Gus Bradley era. I think Coughlin's going to take a more critical eye to just how good this roster is. There are already some reports about some guys who have been veteran key players on this team who are either going to be traded or shopped or let go in free agency.
And what's next for the team?
And free agency, in fact, is
free
what's
agency.
Next. Yeah, they'll have the estate of the franchise address on Wednesday, and then Thursday free agency begins. And with the Jaguars having one of the biggest collections of salary cap space available in the National Football League, I expect that they'll be very active in targeting some players. And there's some areas that they need to get better at. Certainly, offensive line first and foremost. They could use some help on the defensive line. They could use some help at running back, and they could use some help in the defensive backfield. So there are areas for sure to be improved. Not, you know, we talk about quarterback play. I don't think you're going to see the Jaguars make a change in terms of the quarterback, but I do think that they're going to go out and do what they can to try to improve Blake Bortles' play in 2017. That may include bringing in a little more competition or at least a contingency plan at quarterback. Chad Henne has been re-signed, but Henne is not a guy who's going to necessarily push Bortles. There may be somebody out there who could be available, and I think the Jaguars will have to consider that.
All right, and March Madness is upon us. This is sad news from Cole. UNF came up just a little short, making a trip to the Big Dance, and what happened?
Yeah, they lost in the A-Sun Championship game to Florida Gulf Coast, 77-61, third time in the last 6 years that Florida Gulf Coast will represent the league in the Big Dance. So UNF, their season is done. JU was the first victim of UNF in the conference tournament, but there is talk that the Dolphins could go to the CIT, the College Invitational Tournament. It's not the Big Dance. It's not even the little dance, that's the NIT, but it is a chance to play more basketball in the postseason for the Dolphins, and because they had a winning record, it qualifies them to potentially play in the CIT. UNF, who had a better conference record, but had a losing record overall, so they're not eligible to play in the CIT.
But both of these schools have really made moves, you know, in recent years to beef up their athletic teams.
Yeah, certainly.
We're really seeing a lot, big changes in terms of how they're going for these big championships and bigger venues.
UNF has really become one of the teams to contend with in the A-Sun in basketball. JU has improved. They're not quite there. They're maybe a half a step behind. And one of the things that really underlines that fact is that the UNF seniors this year graduate or at least run their eligibility out without having ever lost to JU in the last 4 years, 9 games. So JU's got to improve in that regard, but a chance to play in the CIT can go a long way to helping recruiting and you know, taking that next step as a basketball program.
We'll see you next Monday. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Always listen to the Sam and Cole podcast for more sports news and notes. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And never miss a show. Download our WJCT app and listen anytime. Next on 1A, how to drain the swamp. Despite promises to crack down from both sides of the political aisle, government lobbyists say they're feeling good. A closer look next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Calling all artists, WJCT is celebrating 45 years on the radio. And we need your help to design the perfect anniversary t-shirt. Design should reflect what WJCT means to you or the First Coast community. The winning design will be featured on a limited edition t-shirt during our spring pledge drive. Get started now at wjct.org/45years.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.